Gender, sexuality, transformation, and the language that limits, pigeonholes, or liberates. On this week's 51%, you'll meet the first openly transgender professor at an Orthodox Jewish institution.
In a non-emotional way, I also took it for granted that it was, you know, that I was too much too soon for Orthodox Judaism. But I was wrong.
Then we'll introduce you to an unlikely pair brought together by gender and technology. And you'll hear about slut shaming. That's right, slut shaming. And what one teacher is doing to change the mindset and the words we choose. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Professor Jay Layden made headlines around the world when, after years of teaching literature at Yeshiva University, he returned to the Orthodox Jewish campus as a woman, Joy Layden. Her new book is Through the Door of Life, A Jewish Journey Between Genders. In her story, Layden wrestles with both the practical problems of gender transition and the larger moral, spiritual, and philosophical questions that arise. Layden is a Fulbright scholar and the author of 7 books. She is the first openly transgender employee of an Orthodox Jewish institution. 51%'s Joe Donahue spoke with Layden during her recent visit to Albany, New York. This is part one of a 2-part interview.
When you come to groups like this, what is the overall message that you try to get across?
I'm not sure I think of it in terms of a message. I want to be a human being with other human beings. By talking about my experience of identity and gender and Jewish identity and the ways those things have intersected for me, I'm hoping to help people think about things that are difficult to think about and even talk about because our language isn't designed for it. So I'm hoping to be a beginning of a conversation that many communities, Jewish communities, are just starting to have.
When it comes to the Jewish community and that conversation, what are the tenets of that conversation? What do you think are the questions that you had to answer and the questions that are still being asked in that community?
Well, I think most of the questions regarding what transgender identity is, I mean, even the term transgender identity is an umbrella term that it's a shorthand for referring to many, and we're not yet sure how many different relations to gender. We're still as a culture in the process of figuring out what transgender identity means and how what kinds of social adjustments are required for it. So in all of the communities that I've gone to are usually at the beginnings of that conversation. And there's particular questions in Jewish communities because Judaism, like most traditional religions, is strongly organized in terms of gender. Many Jewish laws are phrased as applying to either men or women and not both. And so there are particular questions of how do you deal with people whose gender identity doesn't fit neatly into those categories? What does that mean? And I think for a lot of people, there's a presumption that transgender identity is a secular concept and that being transgender means rejecting religious identification, a relationship with God, a relationship with the Torah, the Bible, as non-Jews call it. And so I want to be there to show how those identities can intersect and complement each other. For me, being Jewish and having a relationship with God and being trans were intimately related to one another. And I would say that being trans actually fostered my relationship with God and the Torah rather than interfered with it.
So the religious component was always a part of the transition for you.
It was, I mean, long before transition, from the time that I was a child. And when I say religious, a lot of people think in terms of Jewish religion, in terms of the traditional code of law called halacha. And I didn't grow up Orthodox, so I didn't grow up following those traditional laws, although some of them, such as keeping kosher, I observed. But when I talk about Jewish religion, I mean a mode of thinking about what it means to be human, what our obligations are to one another, and a way of thinking about a relationship with God. And I started thinking about those and thinking about them in a Jewish way as a young child, when I was also trying to figure out what it meant to know that I wasn't the boy that everybody thought I was.
How important was it for you to answer those questions and come to terms and know your religion well enough for you to make the transition, or were there other factors? Obviously, there was other factors that play into it as well.
For me, religion was not something that went into figuring out whether I was going to transition or not. For one thing, because I wasn't Orthodox, I wasn't practicing a form of Judaism that had any strong prohibitions against being transgender in any way. It's my Jewish community is welcoming of all kinds of Jews, so it wasn't an issue in that sense. But it was also not an issue because from the time that I was very small, I felt that God was the one person who really knew who I was. God had made me trans, and God was the person I talked with about being trans, and that was always part of our relationship. With the obstacles for me with transition had to do with relations with human beings, particularly the impact of my transition on my family, my wife and my children, and to a lesser extent, but still important extent, what it would mean to, be a teacher, whether I would ever be able to teach again. When I grew up, I assumed that if anybody knew that I was trans, I would be shunned, I would be exiled, I would become, kind of monstrous, either an object of ridicule or maybe an object of horror. And those were the fears that kept me from thinking about transition until my 40s.
You're working at an Orthodox Jewish campus at Yeshiva University, and yes, it's certainly secondary to the family, but it obviously has to cross your mind as to what impact it's going to have on your job. Are you going to be able to teach these students, and what impact is it going to have on the campus? When did that dialogue start with your employers?
Well, I sent a coming out letter to my dean a couple of weeks after receiving tenure, and I assumed that that would be the end of my ability to teach at Yeshiva, and possibly my ability, the end of my ability to teach anywhere. I feared the worst. The dean made a point of meeting with me in person and having lunch with me at a kosher restaurant right near this school, and she told me that I would not be allowed to set foot on campus, that was against the school's policy, but that I would remain a member of the faculty with full salary and benefits. And so that was that was the initial arrangement that we made. Over the course of the following year, my students, I hadn't been communicating with them, but students of mine started contacting me, and they had somehow heard about my transition. They didn't understand it, but for the most part, they were outraged by the way the school was responding to it. They felt that rather than feeling that the school was upholding Jewish law by, keeping a transgender person off campus, they felt that the school was violating Jewish law by treating a human being disrespectfully, that treating human beings with respect is foundational to Judaism, and they felt that as an institution representing Judaism, Yeshiva University had an obligation not to discriminate against me. A number of them went to the dean and talked to her about it, and after a year of what the school called involuntary research leave, I returned to teaching.
How did you understand the university's position?
Oh, absolutely. The dean told me that she believed that students and their families would never accept a professor like me. And because I had grown up assuming that if I ever revealed, you know, who I really was, if I ever started, living as a woman and revealing that I was transgender, I'd always assumed that people would push me away. So at a deep level, this was just the fulfillment of my childhood nightmare of rejection. But I also felt in another way, from teaching at Yeshiva University, I developed a great respect for Orthodox Jewish culture because it kept sending me these extraordinary young women to work with. And I know that traditional cultures take a long time to change. That's the, you know, that's the nature of traditional cultures. And so in a non-emotional way, I also took it for granted that it was, you know, that I was too much too soon for Orthodox Judaism. But I was wrong on both counts.
And it would seem to me there would be a great sense of pride in having the students speak out for you.
Oh, I was extremely proud of my students, and I felt that they taught me a lot about being a Jew and about being a human being. They really represented some of the highest forms of being human. In fact, you know, I grew up in the middle of the 20th century. I'm as full of prejudices and, you know, fears of people who look different than I am as anyone else. And my students showed me that it's my obligation as a Jew to look beyond any difference and see the human being and the image of God in which that human being is created, and respond to that. So not only am I proud of them, I feel that they've taught me an enormous amount.
That was part one of Joe Donahue's interview with Joy Ladin. We will bring you part two on the next 51%.
No law is gonna change us. We have to change us. Whatever God you believe in, we come from the same one. Strip away the fear. Underneath, it's all the same love. About time.
And now we have a story of an unlikely pair brought together by gender and technology. Beta is intersex, which means she does not fit squarely into either gender in a biological sense. Most intersex babies are assigned a gender at birth and undergo surgery. She did not find out until her 20s, and Carrie's story is nearly the same.
To this day, every time I eat a hard-boiled egg, I think about I think about breakfast in Northampton, Massachusetts.
A Tender Moment by Audio Smut. I'm Mitra Kaboli.
I wasn't told that I was intersex, and I had corrective surgery as an infant that I don't remember.
This is Beta. She's an intersex trans woman living in the Midwest.
Growing up was odd for me. I strongly remember fifth grade sex education, and the boys had to watch a film, and the girls had to watch a film, and then the girls watched the boy film, and the boys watched the girls film, and I was sitting there waiting for them to show the film that described my genital configuration. The same year that I became sexually active, I started taking estrogen, and it wasn't until I was 26 and I was with another partner, she said to me, you know, your bits don't look right. I wonder if you're intersex. And I was able to find in this horrible medical records warehouse in North Philadelphia, I was able to go and find my birth records and request a copy of them. And of course, confronted my family about that, and they, to this day, deny that anything happened.
Intersexuality refers to a whole set of different physical variations.
This is Carrie. He's an associate professor of sociology, specializing in LGBT studies at a university in the Midwest. He is also intersex, and his story is similar to Beta's, in that he didn't learn about his intersexuality until much later in life.
Some people are visibly intersex at birth, instantly identified at that moment. Other people, it's not something that's so visible. People who are intersex and genitally variant today in the U.S. still are usually altered surgically And that surgery itself, of course, impacts sexuality, largely because it limits the capacity for sexual sensation, sometimes eliminates it, and also because sometimes the sex to which people are assigned in infancy doesn't turn out to be the sex with which they identify when they are able to speak and talk to people and tell them who they are.
I've always been fascinated by technology, and so as soon as I had a high-speed internet connection, I entered Second Life.
Second Life is a multiplayer role-playing game where people interact with other people, or their avatars, in a virtual world. Beta was contemplating leaving Second Life when one of her friends said that there was this person who was interviewing gender non-conforming avatars. This person doing the interviews was Carrie.
And 10 minutes into the interview, I was in love.
After 9 months of dating in Second Life and 1,000 very real miles between them, they decided that it was time to meet.
At a shabby bed and breakfast, and sort of the world's saddest included breakfast. So I'm a late sleeper and Carrie's more of an early riser, so Carrie would sneak me hard-boiled eggs from the strange little kitchenette.
After the first time they met, they returned back to their homes and spent their time together in Second Life, and every couple of months met up again. Eventually, Beta moved to the Midwest to be with Carrie.
We're married.
We're married.
I mean, we went through a whole lot of crap individually, but you come out a really, you know, that you have a certain level of enlightenment, which would be really great to share with somebody else who could appreciate that. And I have found somebody else who really can. And she's holding my hand now because she loves me. And it's really, you know, it's excellent.
It is excellent.
This tender moment was brought to you by Audio Smut. For the full version of this story and more information about intersexuality, go to audiosmut.ca. I looked all over.
Slut shaming. It's defined as the act of shaming and/or attacking a woman for her sexuality. But a lot of the time, like in middle and high school, it can all revolve around rumors and gossip. Remember that? 51%'s Katie Britton spoke with author and high school teacher Jennifer Mathieu, who first heard about it in a 17 magazine article in the early 1990s. It has stayed with her ever since. So Mathieu decided to put pen to paper, and her new young adult novel, The Truth About Alice, looks at how one lie can get an entire school slut-shaming the girl while patting the boy on the back.
Yeah, you know, I have been asked a couple times, what is slut-shaming? And I think the best definition that I've heard is whenever a girl is humiliated or ashamed or made to feel bad for behavior that, had it been done by a boy, would probably be either ignored or even praised. And I think that girls and boys can definitely be the perpetrators of slut shaming for sure. I had not heard the term myself either when I started writing the book 4 years ago. I didn't intend for it to be the slut shaming book. I understood the concept, of course, as someone who's identified as a feminist for a long time. I'd always known that girls were treated differently when it came to sexuality. But then the term, you know, started kicking around. And if this book can help contribute to the conversation, I'm thrilled.
And it's not just about gossip, but it's about how words can hurt somebody so very much. And whereas some people just take it as, oh, well, I only said one thing, or I only wrote one mean thing on the bathroom stall about her.
Mm-hmm.
But it's how it builds and builds and builds and turns into something where now somebody is ostracized.
Yeah, it's sort of like, you know, death by a thousand cuts, you know, and I think a lot of times that's what teenagers do. They don't really see necessarily see the big picture. And I think, you know, with Alice's story, you know, all these kids are kind of doing little things here and there, and the town sort of turns its back on the situation. I think they just kind of, you know, she's not getting beaten up. She's not getting physically assaulted. It's just sort of these little things, but it all starts to sort of destroy her, all these small little actions. And really the worst thing I think that they do, and the worst thing I think we can do to each other, is they ignore her. You know, of course they do spread awful rumors. They start this slut stall in one of the bathrooms in the high school. But ultimately, they ostracize her, which I think is the way that not just teenagers, but humans in general, that's the cruelest thing that we can do to one another, is to shun each other. And that's really the worst thing, I think, that happens to Alice, is that she just loses all of her friends. You know, one of the quotes that was running through my mind, and I don't know who said it, it's like one of those sayings you hear, but there's this one line that kept running through my mind, which was that if we could remember that all of us inside of us have a story that if we told it, it would break everybody's heart. You know, everybody has a story like that inside of them. And if we treated each other with that knowledge, we would be a lot kinder to one another. So, you know, all of the characters have something inside of them that would break your heart if you heard it, you know, and they just don't remember that, and they don't treat each other with that kindness. So I'm hoping that that's something that teenage readers especially can gain from the book, that understanding that we just need to be gentle with each other.
When this book came out at the beginning of the month, we had just had the Santa Barbara shootings.
Yeah.
And the hashtag YesAllWomen really started to circulate around this book, because it's about taking control and being able to not let those rumors get to you. But if you do sleep with somebody, it's your decision. You're a woman, and you can do what you want as a woman, and that you shouldn't be oppressed by anybody or made to feel bad for who you are.
Yeah, I loved that hashtag. I thought it was just wonderful to see all these women sort of telling their own truths and their own experiences that, you know, are really universal, I think, for all girls and women. And, you know, one thing I think that, you know, there's lots of things that I would hope that this book can spark in terms of a conversation, but one thing I think that we're still, like I said, as a culture, uncomfortable discussing is women and girls' sexuality. I mean, sexuality in general, but even the language that we use, I think, still, you know, girls give away their virginity. They lose their virginity to a man or to a boy. And, you know, it's like there's this sort of intimated that it's this thing that they have that makes them whole, and then they give it away, and then they're not as whole, or they're not as clean, or they're not as pure. And that whole language, I think, really has to stop. And I think that that's sort of at the core of a lot of the stuff that we see girls and women being mistreated. I think that sort of thinking is at the core of a lot of that. And, you know, sort of rating women by their sexuality, or, you know, sort of judging women by how many men they've slept with, how many is too many. And, you know, so it's a big conversation, and there's lots of ways it could go. But I think that that's something that I would love to see as a healthier conversation about sexuality for boys and girls, raising them to make healthy, responsible, fulfilling choices, both of them, boys and girls. I think if we could do that, we would be cutting down on a lot of the sexual violence and assault and sexism that we see in our culture. I really, really believe that.
And do you think we can get to that point?
I hope so. You know, I have a son, and he's a preschooler, and I would love for by the time he's a teenager that the culture would change a little bit. You know, I'm certainly raising him to know that women are whole people and full people and need to be respected and treated that way. You know, and that's one thing that I think I talk about with my own students too. When we treat women as sluts, or we paint women who are sexual as these, you know, sort of prey that needs to be captured, what are we saying about men? You know, we're making them out to be predators, or making them out to be only out for one thing. And I think that's just as harmful to men. I think that if I were a man, I would be insulted to be painted as that sort of animalistic sort of,
right,
you know,
sexual
creature that can't be stopped. You know, we're better than that. Men and women are better than that. And so I really, really hope that we can change the culture. I think we can, one step at a time, and maybe one book at a time. You know, hopefully these books will, because mine's certainly not the only one that's addressed these issues. So hopefully one book at a time, one conversation at a time, we can change things.
That was 51%'s Katie Britton speaking with author Jennifer Mathieu. And that concludes our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton also for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. And if you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. This week's show is 1301. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%.